I'm very pleased to welcome Fremantle Shipping News, Ian D'Souza. Welcome, Ian.
Thank you, Sam, to you. Nice to see you again.
It is lovely to see you again. You're so well known around town, and once people realise I've been interviewing you, I probably will be as well. I remember many, many years ago, my daughter took art classes with you in Fremantle.
Oh.
She'd been going through the special art program in Applecross High School, and she just loved what she did with you. But Ian, you are famous for so many reasons, because you're not just a visual artist, you're not just a watercolourist. You've had so many careers, in a sense. And just before I turned this tape on, you were telling me how you lived in the south of France for 10 years.
Yes.
Whereabouts did you live and why were you there?
Well, gosh, where do I begin? Where would you like me to begin?
Well, what years were we talking about?
I can start from the very beginning when I was born in West Malaysia, and I completed my Cambridge Leaving Certificate in Singapore. And Malaysia and Singapore were ruled by the English then, so I did the Cambridge Leaving in Singapore 1955. Then came to Australia in 1956 on my own. And why did I come to Australia on my own? Is because I was the youngest of six children from a very strict Catholic family, being of Portuguese origin. My grandfather was born in Goa, Indian Portuguese, and my grandmother was born in Macau, Chinese Portuguese. And that's on my father's side. Then my mother's side, there's Portuguese, Dutch, and Indonesian. So it's quite a mixture there. And so when I was born, I was the youngest of six children, and the story goes that when I was born, my mother offered me back to God. And I grew up being reminded that I had to serve the church.
In what capacity?
Being a priest. So it stayed in the back of my mind all through my young days, and then when I finished my leaving, but just before that, I must tell you that the Redemptorists, the missioners who were based in Australia and in Ireland, they came to Singapore and started the novenas on a Saturday. And they were so popular because they were great orators and great singers. And that caught my attention.
So how was it that you came to Australia?
I'm getting to that.
Uh-huh.
So when I finished my leaving, I had to fulfill my mother's dream.
Ah.
So I contacted the Redemptorist missioners and said that I was interested in joining the order. And they said, look, we have a branch, the main branch is in Ireland, but we do have a branch in Australia. But Singapore being closest to Australia, so come to Australia. So I applied and I was accepted, and I left Singapore when I was 16 or 15 and a half on my own, traveled by ship to Fremantle. There were no planes in those days. And then I stayed in the monastery here for a week, and then I caught the train to Geelong, which is a tiny little town near Harden. Yes, do you know Yes?
I know Yes.
That area. So
they, not far from Canberra.
Yeah, they had a novitiate there. So I joined them, started my studies there. And there were 53 young boys from all around Australia to start studying, and I was the only Asian.
It must have been, in every respect, living aside this religious vocation that you were responding to, I take it, a great adventure. You were only 15, 16.
I was very nervous. I was very scared. I was a frightened little boy. I had never travelled, and I was really frightened.
What did you know about Australia back then?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
And what languages did you speak?
English, because...
You were just brought up with English?
Yes, I was brought up speaking English.
Yes. And you completed high school just like a 15, 16-year-old in Australia would have at the same time. And then you come here. How did you find it being in Australia in those first days?
In the early days?
Yes.
It was all strange because there was nothing that I could relate to. Nothing. Even the smells of the gum trees, that was one of the strongest memories is the eucalyptus smell. Because when we landed, when we first touched the coast of Australia, somewhere around Onslow or Broome, we landed there for a couple of hours. Then we walked into town, and I always remember this, walking through these fields and all these these eucalyptus trees, and the smell was so powerful. So that was my first recollection of Australia, is the smell.
And going forward, even though you're in a religious community or a religious setting when you get to Geelong, how did you find Australians? Were they a foreign alien group?
I felt totally out of place. Totally out of place. But I was lucky to have had Father Tom, who happened to have a surname, Father Tom Cruise.
It's a very good name. I see in more recent publications you've dedicated them to him and thanked him.
Yes, because he's been my mentor all my life.
What an amazing and lovely relationship.
Yes. And he said to me, he always used to call me my little boy, my Merv. My name was Mervyn in those days.
Mervyn.
M-E-R-V-Y-N.
That's
my real name.
Well, listeners, there's a scoop on Fremantle Shipping News.
Because we were very much controlled by the English in those early days. My eldest sister was Olga, and then there was Anita, Jeanette, Amy, Ivan, and Mervyn.
A good Catholic family, as you said. But here you are, jumping forward only for a moment, with art books around us, and I've got watercolour images here, and you became an artist. But
let me tell you what's the real story, because there were 50 young boys, and we used to organize plays and concerts, Oklahoma, Trava, Jury, and they wanted somebody to paint the stage backdrops, and I was always good at art at school, and I put my hand up, so I painted these enormous screens for the plays, Oklahoma, Travage, and they were staggered at my talent. So Father Tom then had an idea. He found me a studio in the church, and he encouraged me to paint all the time, day and night.
My goodness.
And I didn't have to do what all the other boys had to do, wake up at 5 in the morning, go to Mass, do that prayers and study. I was painting all day and all night. He used to bring me cups of coffee at 3 in the morning, and I'd be madly painting. And I painted these massive banners from these tiny little holy pictures by El Greco, Rembrandt. So my training started there.
In many respects, it was classical. So Michelangelo...
It was classical. Now when you look at some of my work, you can see
it. You can see it.
That trend.
Well, Michelangelo had the Medici's to sponsor him. You had Father Tom.
I had Father Tom.
Incredible.
And just amazing. If I had somebody else, I wouldn't have been an artist today. They would have said to me, Ian, well, Mervyn, you came here to study to be a priest or a missioner, that's what you are going to do.
So the intersections that we have in life, they happen, and some of them just turn out to be amazing and wonderful.
I believe that we do not have total control of our lives. Our lives are mapped for us. And our role is to find our passion and follow it. As Joseph Campbell talks about the importance of finding your bliss.
Now, Joseph Campbell's another writer and thinker that's important to you.
He's very, very, very important.
Tell our listeners which book they ought to go and read.
He wrote The Power of Myth. And I've been following his, I've been reading and following his interviews for the last 30 years.
And what have you drawn from Campbell?
The meaning of, well, he talks about life, about, he's a famous phrase that there's no meaning to life. What's the meaning of a flea? What's the meaning of an ant? He said, well, what we should be searching for is the experience of being alive. That's our role. And I followed that. I followed his readings a lot, and I tried to apply that to my life.
Well, there are all sorts.
He was a Catholic, but he believes in all of these different religions. Buddhism, Hinduism, plays a big part in his thinking.
Sounds like he believes in humanity, for goodness sake.
And before he died, he did these 6 interviews. They are on tape, called Joseph Campbell, The Power of Myth. It would be good to have a listen to them. They are amazing.
Listeners, Joseph Campbell, The Power of Myth, go to it. But Ian, I'm going to mention 2 words, talking about the power of myth and intersections and what happens to you in life. Bandstand.
Oh my God.
BGs. What, oh my God. Why are you giggling?
Well, I had studied for 4 years at the Minor Seminary. I didn't study, I was painting. So then after the first 4 years, all the boys are sent home for the last time for Christmas to see their families before they came back and joined the major seminary. And once you join that, you are locked in for 14 years studying.
You're in a seminary at that point, it's called the Minor Seminary.
Minor Seminary.
After 4 years, if you've done all the right things.
And yes, and then you go to the
you
next
progress.
Year.
So you go home.
I went home to see my family before I came back to Australia. And while I was in Singapore for Christmas with my family, I started to have doubts whether I was going to be a missioner.
You're not going to tell me that a pretty girl walked past me.
Yes, that's part of that. But I was more, I got totally involved in my art, painting for the church for the 4 years. So going back to the seminary was, it didn't seem that important anymore.
You defined yourself as an artist by the sound of it.
Yes, I just discovered that I could be a painter.
Well, how does this then manifest itself in terms of your career and what you do and the decisions you make?
Now?
Yeah,
when I went back to Singapore, and then I couldn't totally decide whether I wanted to go back to the seminary or continue being a painter. So I decided to come to Perth for a year to study at the Perth Tech. And if I wanted to go back, we'll just jump on the train and go back to the seminary.
So coming to the Perth Tech would what? Would enable you to matriculate to an Australian university, that sort of thing, would it?
I did commercial art.
Oh, you came and did commercial art. Graphic. And Perth Tech was the place where a lot of people went through,
yes.
Architects, graphic yes. designers.
So that was 1960 when I came back.
Now,
61.
You'd been through Fremantle, stayed at the Redemptorist Monastery on your way to the east.
Yes.
So here you are, you're back again.
I'm back to Perth because I thought Perth was Midway. And if I wanted to go back, I'd jump on the train and go back to this.
Well, it's
the century.
It is about midway between KL or Singapore and Sydney, I suppose.
And then when I was here for that year, of course, being a singer, and then we had other parties.
Well, hang on. You just said singer, and you've now said guitar. Where did all this come from?
Well, we always. Let me go back a little bit, because there were six children in my family, four girls and two boys, and being strict Catholics, after dinner we all said the rosary, and then we all sang. My dad played the violin, my mum played the piano, so we could all sing and dance.
And instruments?
Instruments as well.
What did you play?
I played guitar.
Oh, right.
I learned the guitar, so dad played the piano, so that was our thing. After dinner, we'd do that, and they were great times.
You could have gone, your family, travelling the world as the D'Souza family singers.
My dad was an engineer, my mum was a school teacher, but times were different. That, you know, there was no television in those days. So we had to entertain ourselves, so we all could dance and play music.
Well, Ian, this
which is sadly lacking these days.
Well, it isn't, I think. It's here and there, but that's it. 1960, we arrived here, year at Perth Tech to do the graphic design work, graphic art, commercial art, and you play the guitar, you sing, and then you start talking about singing. So what happened? Did you get into the music industry?
I had to get into the, because I had to support myself as well. So I thought, what can I do to earn some money? So I started to sing, and I entered all the singing competitions in Perth, and I won them all. I won them all because I had a beautiful voice.
Well, I can tell that just by talking to
and
you.
And then I sang on Channel 7, Channel 9, Channel 2. I started the first pop singing group in West Australia.
And what did you call
it? The Millionaires.
The what?
The Millionaires. There were four Asians.
Like mayonnaise, but the Millionaires.
Millionaires.
Yes, from because you what? Four of you were from Malaya.
And we could all play and sing. So we could all harmonize. So we used to sing in all the pubs around town, win all the singing competitions.
And what were some of the songs or the genre that you...
In those days, I did a lot of Harry Belafonte songs.
Ah.
And we harmonized a lot of the pop songs from the 50s and 60s. You know, Buddy Holly and...
Well, I can see you standing up front doing Buddy Holly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but we became so popular. We used to sing in Bunbury for Easter, and the crowds used to drive down to Bunbury, the Highway Hotel, and because we were singing there in 1961.
Wow, sex, drugs, and rock and roll there.
Yes, and then I got involved with the partying and the girls and the women and all that. So forget the monastery.
Well, remember the monastery and be thankful for being released.
So I became a pop singer, and I sang all over Australia. I sang on Bandstand with the Bee Gees when they were just beginning. They were 10 and 12. Brian Henderson. And I entered in 1963 or 64. I entered their big competition, singing competition, like what they have now, the Australian Idol. And out of 5,000 entrants singing for the competition, I came third. And but to get that far was amazing because I was Asian. And in those days, there was the White Australian policy. So even if I was the best, I would never have won.
Well, talk to Kamal about that.
Yeah, well, he came about the same time.
Yes, very interesting. Now, while you were doing that and getting carried away with a very secular life, what happened to your painting, Ian?
Nothing.
You weren't painting?
I was not painting.
Oh, my goodness.
And then I started to sing full time in the clubs around Perth.
Yes.
And then I met my second wife, and she was a model and a singer. And I admired her singing very much, but we had never met. But then we happened to be working in the same nightclub, and we fell in love, and we lived together. And then when my divorce went through in 68, 69, I had two children. We left Perth and started to travel the world, starting with Singapore. We had a contract in Singapore. So we started traveling the world, singing with all the big hotels from 1970. We were singing in Singapore, Kuala Lumpur, Johor Bahru, Jakarta, Bali. Bali in 1970, there was no one there. My gosh, there was only one hotel, the Bali Beach, Intercontinental Hotel. And even then, there were hardly any tourists. And we used to play cards and Monopoly with the managers and the hotel staff until there was a phone call, there's a plane arriving with some tourists. Everybody would rush to their post.
Exercise your vocal cords.
Yeah, and then I was singing there for 3 months, entertaining. And then we started to travel. We just did all of Malaysia. We did Bangkok. We did all of the Pakistan with all the big hotels in Pakistan, and all over India with the Oberoi Hotels. And then we had contracts to sing in Germany. Then we went to Beirut for 3 years. I lived in Beirut for 3 years singing, and Beirut was just amazing.
People have always told me who've been there, I haven't, that it's
Paris of the Middle East,
a place to go. And you look what's happening right now. Yes.
So I was very lucky to be able to live and see these countries, even Tehran. And we were singing in Tehran at the Intercontinental, and we had a contract. We went there for a month's contract, and when we got there, we discovered that they hadn't finished building the hotel. So they paid us every night for not working until they had completed the hotel. And the hotel happened to be owned by Empress Farideba. Half of it was owned by her. And when they completed the nightclub, we were singing every night. And the whole royal family used to come to the show. And one night, we had just finished our one-hour show, because we based our show on a man and a woman in love, fashion, and song, because my wife was a model, in one of the top models in Perth in the 60s. So the whole show was based on love songs. I was dark, she was fair, blonde, blue-eyed. We used to hold hands and sing love songs, and people used to melt.
I'm melting now.
So that was our big selling point. And because she was a model, our whole show was based on our costumes. We had the best costumes. We spent all our money on the costumes, hand beaded. And I used to do a lot of the beading myself. Sit on the beach for hours beading her dresses. And so we were known as the best dressed singing couple in Asia in the 60s and 70s.
Did you have a performance name? Were you a band?
Yes, Ian and Shell in Love, Fashion and Song.
Well, Ian.
And then we traveled all over the world, and Beirut for 3 months, Tehran. One night, as I was saying, we finished our show and the doors opened, and I didn't know who was there. And I said, oh, thanks for coming late. Anyway, it was her, Empress Farideba. She came in, she came backstage and said, I've heard so much about your singing. Would you please sing for me?
Oh.
So we had to do the whole show just for her.
Just for her.
And she gave us two of the gold Pahlavi coins.
Oh my goodness. So, from the Middle East, you're in your 30s at this stage.
I was in my 30s.
Yes.
And then we were traveling, and we were living in Beirut for three months, and we had a contract in Germany for 6 months every year.
Yes.
I used to drive from Beirut to Germany every 6 months, and we drove through this tiny little town in the south of France, and I smashed my car windscreen, and I had to stay in that town for 3 days to get it repaired. And while we were there, I thought I might look at some of of these beautiful old French houses. And I saw this farmhouse that had 14 rooms in it, and it had belonged to a sculptor who had a big studio. So I was drawn to the fact that it was a studio as well as a farmhouse. So we bought that. We went to Kenya to work for 9 months, and we bought the house for $18,000 in 1971.
You're going to make a lot of people feel quite jealous, and some people will recall their travels in these places when you could have travelled in those places. And in a sense, you're living a life you can't really have imagined until a few years earlier.
Yeah, I mean, you know, things just happened to me, and I've never had any plan. I was like a feather in the wind. I lived my life through instinct. It felt good. And then when the oil crisis hit in Europe in 1974, all of our contracts had been cancelled, Germany especially, because we had contracts for 6 months. So people couldn't drive in those days that far, so the contracts were cancelled. And we were broke. I was stuck in this 15, the house was built in 1592, and I spent 6 years trying to restore it. And so we had a call from a friend who was living in Beirut. He said, look, there's a new nightclub opening. Would you want to come? The timing was perfect. We didn't have any money, so they sent us our air tickets, and we flew to Beirut. And we stayed and worked in the Middle East for 3 or 4 years, including Dubai in 1974. When the war started in Beirut, we went to Dubai.
Dubai,
there was only one street with those boats, the dhows. That's all there was.
Well, by rights, we're talking about television shows like Idol earlier. You could be the older judge on that show these days if you'd stayed in the music industry. What happened? How did you cease being in the music industry?
And then, worked on the house for 6 years. Then they discovered uranium in my backyard. And they opened the biggest open-cut uranium mine in Europe in my little village.
Wow.
So the government told me that I had stopped work and how they had to take over the house. They bought me out.
Wow.
They paid me what they thought it was worth. So what was a valley with a stream and a beautiful old stone house became a mountain of rubble. Mm. They used to blast every day at 1:30 underground, and the whole house used to shudder. So then, in my travels, because I used to travel singing around the world 9 months every year and restore the house for 3 months. So when I went back to restore the house in that year, I couldn't do any work on the house. So I saw an exhibition in my travels of watercolor in a bank somewhere in Europe. And I thought, wow, this looks easy, I can do that.
Watercolor, anyone can do that.
I know. So I bought my first tin of watercolors, went back to the south of France in 1977. And I went out painting all day, sitting in the car painting the little villages in the south of France, and I got totally obsessed. Totally obsessed.
So you're going around painting little villages in the south of France, and
without any training.
Without any training, you thought I can do this.
Yeah, it's so easy, but I discovered it wasn't easy. And the harder it got, the more obsessed I became.
Well, you needed to get some lessons. You needed to chase up Ian D'Souza or someone and learn how to do it.
Yeah, because I'm completely self-taught. So when I sold the house in the south of France and came back to Fremantle in 1980...
That's what you did.
I had to sell the house.
And you came here.
I came back to Fremantle because my wife was from Fremantle. So when we came back here, I gave myself 3 years to see whether I could make a living from my painting. And I used to go out... 7-8 hours every day, 7 days a week, sitting in my little Suzuki, painting Fremantle. All the images are there.
I've got a book here.
Yeah, that's the early work from Fremantle in 1980.
Let me tell our listeners, it's titled Reflective Impressions. It's Ian D'Souza.
Ross had to go through...
Ross D'Souza, your current wife.
Yeah, she had to go through 900 slides of my paintings to choose 90 or less to put this book out.
It's just fabulous. I mean, there's two parts to it. One part has what looked like the Kimberleys,
yes,
or the Pilbara.
Just to show where I was going.
But there are other parts of it, and the delightful thing about this book is that it's historical and it's in chronological order.
Look, so, I mean, all this is gone, huh?
I've just turned up at page 26, and it's the blessing of the fleet. Well, fortunately, that still happens.
That's where Kalis.
But not the scene.
I know, that's where in the Kalis is now.
Yes. So that was Fishing Boat Harbour, but not as you'd know it today.
No. And this is North Fremantle, where everybody used to go fishing.
And then you look at that.
And all that's gone now.
Service jetty to the harbour, 1982, and that's over the other side, where sort of North Quay is.
Yeah.
And so this book and your paintings, which we still have, and we'll come to the exhibition that's on at the moment, tell a story about a Fremantle that we know about, but we no longer see, only through your paintings.
Yeah.
So you're going out each day in the Suzuki, spending hours perfecting your technique. Are you still self-taught? Did you go and get some professional?
No, I'm still completely self-taught.
Oh, my goodness.
So I just went on my journey and learned from my own. I learned through sheer work. And when I teach, I tell people, you have to follow your bliss, like Joseph Campbell talks about. You find your passion, and then with passion comes self-discipline. If you don't have self-discipline with passion, it won't work. So if you find your passion and are able to pursue your passion a minimum of 6 hours a day, you cannot help but be the best. And I heard Kieran Perkins, the swimmer, and the games, he was in an interview, and he said this. He said, if you can do what you love to do a minimum of 6 hours, you cannot help but be the best in the world. And I thought, wow, this is it. So I'm going to paint a minimum of 6 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I want to be the best in the world.
Ian,
and
this is
still painting.
This is inspiring. For more than 40 years now, you've had various exhibitions.
All over the world, yes.
All over the world. I've been to a good number of them and always enjoyed them. Tell our listeners, has your style or has your approach to your art changed? Have you changed the medium? Have you changed what you're thinking? Tell us about it.
Well, I think when you're so passionate, you are your best teacher. And I discovered this through my work. And I would stick to a style of work for a while, and all of a sudden, things would start to fail. And it took me a long time to understand why they failed, because I had to go through that journey of failure. And then I wake up one morning and I do something completely different, and I'm on to the next step without even understanding how and why. That's how it works.
It's interesting, isn't it? You had, not to reinvent yourself, but you had to re-express yourself.
Yes. And so you go for a certain length of time doing amazing work, and then all of a sudden everything starts to fail because something else is happening.
So how would you explain? Do you have names for the different periods you've gone through?
No, I don't. I don't think about what I do. I never analyze what I do. I just do it. And I tell my students this, don't think too much. You just follow your path instinctively. Your work is your best teacher. It will tell you where you're going and how you're going. Your job as an artist is to just continue regularly working.
Now,
that's part of the journey.
Part of the journey. Right now is an exhibition that opened on the 2nd, a couple of days ago, over Easter, a soft opening of some, not all of your work. You'd need a giant warehouse to show that. In South Fremantle, or in Fremantle, in fact, in South Terrace. Tell our listeners what it's called and where they'll find it.
Okay, this the work I'm showing at Found and Sorted, which is the real estate office there, and she's name is Denise. She's very kindly allowed artists to show their work in the lobby.
It's a lovely big
lovely
office
open space, and yes, her office is behind. So she had a cancellation. She's fully booked out for 3 years.
There's always an art exhibition.
She doesn't charge anybody anything.
Oh, really?
No commission, no fees, nothing. And that's her contribution for the artists, to the artists.
It's also helping to make that little Ray Avenue precinct hum,
yes,
as well.
Yes, and it's been going, and it's getting extremely popular. So she's fully booked out for sure, but she had a cancellation.
So between
she
the
called me and she asked me whether I would show some works there.
Yes, please. So between the 2nd of April, which has come and gone, and the 29th of April, this is happening. And you're doing an artist's talk, I think, about the 16th.
Because of Easter, we're having the official opening a bit later. So we'll open on the 16th and I'll talk about the work and my journey.
And what do you call this exhibition? What's its title?
It was Pilgrim to the Port.
Yes. So
now the works of the Pilgrim,
which you're seeing,
I did 25 years ago.
Now, what took you to the Pilgrim?
I went there with a group of artists, and this is another story, guys. Because I was always afraid of the Australian landscape.
We were coming from a very closed landscape in Malaysia. So the Australian landscape has always been very, very forbidding for me. But I was invited to join a group of artists, and I went up with them to the Kimberley first for 3 weeks. And everything, this is after painting in Fremantle for 20 years, I went up with a group of artists to attempt to paint the Australian landscape. And I failed with every image that I tried to capture, I failed. And I thought to myself, what's happening here? After 20 years' work, I'm failing so badly. And then on the last day, when we were packing up to leave the Kimberley, I took my paints and I walked along the Wijina Gorge.
Oh, so this is in the Kimberleys at this point?
Kimberley.
I painted
from 7 in the morning to 3 in the afternoon. I walked along and painted all along the Wijina Gorge, and everything worked because I gave up. I thought, I'm not meant to paint the Australian landscape, and I just playfully painted the Wijina Gorge, and the 6 of them are in this book.
Yes.
And
they're really something.
And they're now hanging in a beautiful apartment in New York.
Well, I'm not surprised in a place like that where they'll be truly appreciated. The Wijina Gorge is an amazing place. So you found a way to the Kimberleys, you confronted the demons when it came to Australian landscape, and you also went to the Pilbara.
Well, that was a bit later.
Yes.
But just let me finish the story about the Kimberleys.
Yes.
I failed because I was trying too hard. And it's only when I gave up, it worked.
Isn't that interesting?
So I learned a lot from that. So these ones of the Kimberley are beautiful paintings.
Yes.
Of the Kimberley.
And they're in the reflections. Look at them.
They only happened when I lost my fear of it.
Isn't that, I find that fascinating. And you've explained before how you hit a wall or whatever it is and you can't, and you fail, to use your expression, and suddenly what's meant to be happens.
Yeah, and
you must have felt really good, because when you look at these, and I'll put an image up of them for the listeners to look at, from the Kimberley's Wijina Gorge, it's different from what you've done otherwise.
I was very much inspired by the Chinese paintings. They painted their mountains like this.
Yes.
And also, I was into drawing and painting the female form in those years. So I applied the human form to the landscape.
You're telling me the Kimberleys are the female form?
I could see in the human form in the in the gorge.
Yes.
But the most interesting thing is that I was. While walking at 7 in the morning, painting all these from 7 in the morning, it was so eerie. There was no one in sight. But I felt I was being watched. And I looked in the river, and there were crocodiles in the river watching me. And then much later, I was talking to an Aborigine man. He was saying they used to bury their dead in this Winjana Gorge. Because there were a lot of caverns in the gorge. They were very high. And I was being watched on both sides, behind me and in front, and in the water.
Well, if you were going to be confronted with fear of the Australian landscape and get over it, Winjana Gorge is obviously the place.
You have to go there because you will be watched.
Later on, you say, because this exhibition currently on is...
And then I went to the Pilbara.
Or to Pilbara. Then you went to Pilbara.
I went to Pilbara with a smaller group.
And did you have a similar experience there?
No, I was... After this experience, I learned a lot about not trying too hard, but just giving in to the landscape. Because the landscape is so powerful, especially in the Pilbara.
Mm. You go up to places like Carrageenie. Oh my goodness.
The colours, I mean, they change every hour because of the amazing Spinifex, which is silver. And when the light changes, it hits the silver. So that the pinks and the greens and the blues all seem to come out in the landscape.
Now, I just want our listeners to know a couple of technical things. I would like to know a couple of technical things. When you first started painting in watercolours, what sort of paints did you use? What sort of material did you paint on? And when you do the Winjana Gorge series here, are you using the same sorts of materials?
Same materials.
And
watercolours and or gouache or acrylics with a lot of water. So I don't tend to place a lot of importance on the medium. I use the medium that I feel would suit the subject.
But in more recent times...
Let me go back to watercolours. I started with watercolours because it was the most difficult medium. And I thought that if I can master watercolours, I can do anything. So that was my passion. If I can do watercolours, everything else is easy.
Kieran Perkins, 6 hours a day, yeah. And I'll nail it.
And also you're working with water. You cannot make water do what it doesn't want to do. So that's where the training, which is a very Eastern philosophy. So you can see, when I first started painting, I was very much drawn to the Western style of art, the Impressionists. And as I'm getting older and I'm turning more to my Eastern heritage, that's why I'm working on rice paper and watercolors. Then I'm bleeding the inks on rice paper, which is not done the way it, when I went to China to meet a lot of the artists, they laughed at me when I told them the way I was working with rice paper. They said, this is not how we do it. But I said, this is how I want to do it. I'm trying to combine the East and West.
Well, I've seen your rice paper work. Not so long ago, at an exhibition that was on in the Moores Building.
Yes, that's right.
Tell our listeners a little bit about rice paper, what rice paper is and how you use it in your art.
Rice paper is a very, very fragile surface to work with. It's like working with tissue paper. And especially when you're working with water or inks, you just can't control. I tend to... with all of my work, I always tend to go for the most difficult way of working because everything else below that will be easy. Mm. That's been my whole philosophy. And the way I discovered working with water is quite unique, and it happened totally by accident. And this also shows you how your life goes backwards. I found that image of the Passion of Christ, what I did when I was 16, for the church. And I entered this competition in West Australia in 2004. It was based on the Passion of Christ for the Mandola Art Religious Award. The theme was the Passion of Christ. And what came to mind was this image of the crown of thorns I did when I was 16. So I found this image of the painting I did, and playfully in my studio I put, as an experiment, I put six sheets of rice paper, one on top of each other. And I painted with inks the face of Christ with the crown of thorns. And when I peeled each layer off, the hair on my back and my neck stood on end. I could see the journey of Christ from man to God. As the ink went through, it didn't touch areas, so it became less and less. The spaces became more powerful. The emptiness, which is a very strong Buddhist philosophy, we should spend more time thinking about the spaces, empty spaces in our life. Because they are just as important. You cannot have one without the other. And when you leave this world, you go into your empty spaces. That's how the empty spaces are.
Well, your description and my memory of looking at those series of images is dead right. I can remember thinking, wow, how did you do that? Ian, I just want to read something from another book. This is it, Clear Light. Yeah. The artist's statement. The past 40 years have been dedicated to my art practice, and it has taken me that long to arrive at this new stage in my work, exemplified in this exhibition, Clear Light, a state of minimum distraction. I consider my earlier work to be derived from an external point of view. This new body of work points to an internal journey of life, emphasizing the duality of life and the power of empty space. Clear Light. End the quote.
Right.
And that's what you've just been describing, the power of empty space. Try and explain what that means to you, the power of empty space.
Well, at this time of my life, at 87, I feel that I am approaching that stage of my life where I will go into empty spaces. And I totally understand the whole journey, and I accept it. I don't have a choice. Whatever leads on after the empty spaces, I am looking forward to finding out. This is part of our journey of life. Just like the face of Christ I painted, but through the layering of inks going down to the empty spaces of the face of Christ. You can see the power of the empty spaces.
Well, you've also brought it out in another piece called In the Shallow Sky, the Beauty and Sweetness of It. This is ink on rice paper.
Yeah.
And you can see the empty spaces in a sense. You can feel them.
Yes, they become so powerful. And there's a painting here, because I had open heart surgery in 2019. This one. And I painted this after my operation, or my open heart surgery.
And this one is called When Breath Becomes Air. And I can see why you would have.
Yes, so this is the tree of life.
Yes.
Loosely, and this is my heart.
Yes.
And this is, if I had gone into the other space, this is where I would have ended.
So to the viewers, and we'll try and put this image up.
This is my journey.
And this is a triptych. You've got the three pieces.
Yeah.
You can see the journey. Ian, I mean, you've lived, I suppose you might say, at times, a manic life. You've been caught up rushing this way and that, doing all of this. Would that be fair? Are you a bit manic?
I've always been manic. Always been manic in my work and my life. But and I have embraced that. And I think if I wasn't so manic, I wouldn't have achieved so much that I feel I have achieved. And there's nothing more in life that I want. Really, there's nothing more, but just to stay healthy as possible and enjoy the rest of my life. And I live in a beautiful sanctuary.
You do.
Where I spend a lot of time talking to my plants and touching them.
And they thrive. They respond. Even though I'm not a gardener, I know nothing about plants. I choose my plants because of their shape, sculptural shape. I love some of the shapes of the leaves. And
so it's what I'm intrigued is about their journey as well. And I can relate my journey in that way as well. So I spend a lot of time in my garden talking to my plants.
Ian, we're coming to the end of this podcast. It's been really lovely talking to you. You filled me with inspiration in various ways, and I'm sure people listening to this will be feeling this as well. Those who are living around Frio should get in to the exhibition.
This exhibition, they're the ones on Fremantle. I did with just tonal values. No.
So they look, in a sense, black and white.
Yes, and because I wanted the emphasis to be on the pilgrim, the colours. So any colours I use on Fremantle would have clashed with the pilgrim. So I kept it separate. But the most unusual thing, without me knowing it, is that I've gone back to my early days in the style work. Because someone said, gosh, Ethan, this is what you used to do.
Exactly.
There's the circle of life again.
Well, there's one that's hanging in the big window before you walk through the door, and it's exactly what you described.
Yeah.
It's delightful.
And it goes back to the 80s.
Well, people have to get along to see this
exhibition. I'll be there, and I'd love to talk with them.
And you're doing a talk on the 16th as well.
On the 16th. They'll be open on the 16th.
Well, Ian D'Souza, thank you for joining me today. You've had a wonderful career, and congratulations.
Thank you so much.